Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Tony Van Huysen serves as Governor Dennis Dugard's chief of staff. He's also something of a history and political science buff with a particular interest in the history of South Dakota's governors. Van Huysen has written a book cataloging the chief executives of the state. He joins us now via phone from Pierre with more. Tony, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Let's talk about how this book went from idea to publication. How did it start for you?
Sure. You know, it really started the end of Governor Dugard's first year in office that November. Governor Bill Janklow announced that he had brain cancer and was dying. And at that time, we had a couple folks working in our office who had also worked for Governor Janklow, and we got to talking about him and the things that he had accomplished in his 16 years as governor and wondered how that compared to the other governors in our state's history, and found as we were talking that once you got past, you know, earlier than Frank Farrar or Dick Knight maybe, that with a couple exceptions, we really didn't have very much knowledge about what some of these earlier governors had done. We might have heard of their names, you know, be it Joe Foss or Coe Crawford or Arthur Millett, or some of them are even less well-known than that, but we didn't really know very much about them. And so I sort of started what became a so far about a five-year project to just learn more about the former governors, read about them, find people who've written about them, and try to compile that information into one place, mostly for my own use.
So how for your own use? That's curious to me. How are you using it?
Well, you know, working in the governor's office, it certainly comes in handy to have that historical perspective, and sometimes doing speech writing, it can offer information that's useful to the governor. I'm on the board of directors for the Trail of Governors Foundation here in Pierre, which is erecting the life-size bronze statues of every former governor, and certainly this research has come in handy with that for writing the biographical sketches that the trail uses, or even offering information to the sculptors as they're thinking about concepts to portray those former governors.
Were you surprised that nothing already existed, that it hadn't been established to sort of gather that history in one place before now?
Yes and no. You know, there was a book written around the time of the state centennial that has biographical sketches of the former governors, and I certainly relied on that for some of the earlier ones. There's been a lot of writing about South Dakota history, and in fact, the bibliography in the back of my book is probably 10 or 12 pages. A lot of that is done through the South Dakota Historical Society and the History Journal or in other books, but it is fun to try to compile all that information in one place, almost in an almanac-like format.
Right. Let's describe the format of this book. So it is a catalog, an almanac. You can go through and hit some of those highlights. How did you decide what to include and what not to then?
Sure. I have a lot of books about former presidents and looked at some of those to get ideas about how to format it. So for each former governor, I tried to have a standard format. I have a picture of that governor's portrait, which is downstairs here at the Capitol, a copy of his signature, which I got from the state archives, and then beginning with the basic biographical information, name, when he served, political party, where he was from, and then a short synopsis, but then for each one, sort of a bulleted list giving information about early life, education, family, including the First Lady, the career leading up to being governor, the results of the gubernatorial elections that elected that particular governor. Then usually the longest section is the events that occurred while that governor was in office, what things he undertook or what other things occurred. And then what that governor did after he left office, information about his death for those that have passed away. And then I also tried to include who served in the other statewide offices during that time, who served in the legislative leadership during that time, what was the party composition, what are some historical milestones that governor might have met, and then how has that governor been honored? Are there things named after him, you know, the statutes for those that have those, that type of thing. Trying to get all the information about each governor in one place.
How about controversies? Are those included in the book at all?
Yeah, they certainly are. You know,
I think we have lost Mr. Van Huysen. We're talking to Tony Van Huysen. We'll try to get him back here on the phone in just a minute. He's Governor Dennis Dugard's chief of staff and a history and political science buff as well. His book is called Governors of South Dakota, or South Dakota's Governors, I'm sorry. Maybe got that title wrong. The Governors of South Dakota is what it's called, and it's kind of an almanac catalog reference book with historical information about all the governors that the state have. So we're trying to get Tony Van Huysen back on the phone from Pierre so we can continue this conversation. Also want to ask him here about the Trail of Governors Foundation. He mentioned that and being on that board. So hopefully he'll be here with us in just a minute. Tony Van Huysen, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm sorry we got cut off somehow.
No problem. We were talking about controversies. I reminded people about your book, The Governors of South Dakota. Let's jump back right into where we were. How did you address some of the more controversial aspects of certain governors' history?
Well, it's certainly included in the book, usually in the section about that governor's tenure. Most of our governors have done a good job and good overall, and I tried to portray that. I don't think I painted any of them in a bad light, but there's certainly been controversies, everything from, the first state treasurer back in the early 1890s literally stole the state treasury and absconded to Latin America, and I discussed that in the sections having to do with Governor Millett, who actually stepped up and repaid much of that himself, even though it wasn't his fault. His successor, Governor Sheldon, who had to deal with the aftermath. Cole Crawford was later governor, but he was the attorney general who had to investigate that and eventually prosecuted the former treasurer. You know, there's others. Governor Norbeck was probably one of our best governors, but he instituted something called the Rural Credit Program that was supposed to be a state-operated loan program for farmers. Problem was it was set up during the 1920s, early 20s, when land prices were very inflated, and then when the land prices crashed, the state wound up losing just tens of millions of dollars. And you know, there were more recent controversies too. Everything from the Gina Score death when Bill Janklow was governor, and I even talk about the current controversies with EB-5 and Gear Up in a bullet point on Governor Dugard. So certainly not trying to avoid those topics.
What's been the response so far from readers?
Pretty good. You know, this isn't a book that I've really attempted to market at all.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I made it for my own use, and I've printed a few here and there to give to friends or family, or as the word is spread, people who are interested. I do have a few copies that are available, but I've gotten a very good response. I think it's pretty concise. It puts all the information in one place, and I think people enjoy being able to look that up.
You've mentioned some of those more familiar governors' names. You mentioned Governor Peter Norbeck and others throughout our conversation. What makes certain governors in your mind sort of stand out as memorable and, you know, having a long-lasting legacy?
Sure. It seems like the governors who are remembered were governors who tried to move the state forward, tried to push an agenda, make changes. You know, most of our governors, practically all of them, have been pretty fiscally conservative and have been good managers. But you take somebody like Peter Norbeck, who did everything from creating Custer State Park, promoting the creation of Mount Rushmore, holding the first pheasant hunting season. I mean, that's a guy, he took office just 100 years ago this month, and there's a guy who the changes he made are still things that really affect South Dakota today. Hmm. Our more recent governors are like that, too.
Who else stands out to you that has a legacy that we remember, at least?
Sure. You know, I would say Governor Knipe certainly is more recent, but he made a lot of institutional changes in state government, everything from the four-year term for the governor, the cabinet system, creating the unified judicial system, really modernized state government in a way that set it up to be successful and is still successful today. Governor Janklow, certainly, we all remember him. He was always very aggressive and had a lot of accomplishments, and of course served twice as long as any other governor, which gives him a leg up also.
Right. So Richard Knipes, 1971, right? Do right. I remember that correctly? Okay.
That's
and
right.
then Governor Janklow, 79, and then again in the 90s, 1995?
Sure, that's right. And there are certainly others I could mention too. George Mickelson, actually both Mickelsons had, father and son had notable accomplishments. Tom Barry back in the Great Depression. A lot of interesting people, some of them more remembered than others, which is what makes this book fun.
If you're just joining us, the book is The Governors of South Dakota. We're talking with Tony Van Huysen, who is Governor Dennis Dugard's chief of staff and has been working on this on his own time. Tell me, Tony, about the Trail of Governors Foundation Board and your work there for a few minutes.
Sure. The Trail of Governors was started in 2011 or 2012. The original idea was came from a couple of businessmen here in Pierre, who Rick Jensen and Leroy Foster are their names, who saw the Trail of Presidents in Rapid City, thought it would be neat to have something like that in Pierre for the governors, researched a little and found that no state in the country has done that. And so they started raising the funds and commissioning three statues a year starting in 2012 with the goal of eventually having every former governor portrayed on a trail throughout the capital city here in Pierre. I got involved with the trail maybe 3 years ago, originally as a resource as I was working on this book to offer historical information, and then was invited to be on their advisory board, and then about a year ago was invited to be on the board of directors. But it's a neat project. 15 of the statues have been erected so far. There are 30 former governors. Governor Dugard will be the 31st former governor when he leaves office. So things are progressing. This June will be the first time that we unveil four statues in a year instead of three. So as the project has continued, there's been more interest, and we're hoping we can get it done a little faster.
What do you think is the value? Can you articulate the value of a project like that and sort of commemorating the leadership of the state in that particular way?
What I think is really neat about the Trail of Governors, and I'd say this is a goal of my book too, is to remind South Dakotans about some of these historical figures who maybe aren't so well-remembered, lead us to learn about them and revisit the time that they served and the accomplishments that they had. You know, it's neat on the Trail of Governors. They try to have statues that don't just necessarily portray the guy standing there in a suit and a tie, but portray him doing something that represents what he achieved. So Peter Norbeck is dressed in outdoor clothes with surveying equipment. He laid out Iron Mountain Road himself. I did a lot of the fencing for Custer State Park himself. You have Robert Vesey, who I can see out my window here in front of the State Retailers Association, dressed as a shopkeeper. He was one of the founders of the Retailers Association, and so he's dressed in that way and stands outside their office. And so on like that, Governor Janklow is wearing a highway patrol jacket and holding a bullhorn, recalling his in-person response to the Spencer tornado and other disasters like that. So,
as you did the research for this book, Tony, and then we'll let you go, I'm just curious if you were finding any messages for the current administration.
I think we have. You know, it's clear as you go back and read this that South Dakotans expect a governor who is fiscally conservative, who focuses on managing the state well and in a sound manner, and I certainly think Governor Dugard has always attempted to do that. But they also appreciate leaders who try to find an opportunity and seize it and try to move the state forward. And I think maybe in some instances that's led the governor to be more aggressive because he sees that in the past that our governors have taken opportunities to be aggressive, and that's usually been a good thing. So,
The book is called The Governors of South Dakota. It's a reference book written by Tony Van Huysen, serves as Governor Dennis Dugard's chief of staff. Thank you for being with us today in The Moment.
Thank you, Laurie.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. You won't find this on most calendars, but National Seed Swap Day takes place on the last Saturday in January. Seed swaps have been held annually, various locations across the nation for varying numbers of years. This year, Rapid City joined them. On Saturday afternoon, around 100 people showed up in the first hour to trade seeds at the Rapid City Public Library. SDPB's Victoria Wicks has this story.
Library Associate Catherine Kuntz says some of the national drive to share seeds has been done through catalogs and by mail. But when there's a public venue, people are able to bring in seeds and carry some away.
We had a patron bring in Love in a Puff. So it's a little climbing vine type plant that's very delicate. And then the seed is within the little puff and it has a little heart on it. And so it's very much a Love in a Puff. And then we had people bring in parsnip seeds. We had people bring in kohlrabi and kale and tons of different seeds from their gardens, like marigolds and all that.
Kuntz said swapping seeds makes economic sense, not only because buying seeds can be expensive, but also because households can become more self-sustaining.
You can also plant your carrots and parsnips and peppers and tomatoes without having to rely on our grocery stores. And so you could potentially sell them at the local farmer's market.
Kuntz says a seed swap is social. It creates a community venue where gardeners can come together to talk gardening. And those of us who grow food and flowers know how rewarding it is to hear tips and advice from those with more experience. Michelle Grosick of Bear Butte Gardens is one of those experienced gardeners with a wealth of information.
We grow organic vegetables, then we grow mostly heirlooms so we can save the seed from those and get the same thing the next year. And so it's just a fun cycle, I think, to grow something and then be able to keep a little piece of that and give it away to someone else to grow it in their own backyard.
Grosick says all flowers, fruits, and vegetables can be heirloom. She explains that heirloom means the same thing as open pollination. When you save the seed and plant it next year, you'll get the same result. Hybrid seeds come from two plants that have been crossed by humans for a specific purpose, like color or size. If you save those seeds, she says, you might not get the same qualities next year. Grosick says hybrid does not mean genetically modified, and sometimes hybrid seeds are preferred.
A lot of organic seed is open pollinated. That's kind of a favorite, but there's also hybrids in there. There are certain vegetables that are hard to find heirloom varieties, and like the brassica family is one of those. So Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, I frequently go to a hybrid on those just because it's hard to find a good heirloom.
Library staff hope to make this seed exchange an annual event and to have more gardening programs during the planting and growing season. People in the Black Hills can also find gardening advice at the Black Hills Farmers Market and through Pennington County Master Gardeners. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City.
Up January in South Dakota, we look ahead to days when the snow recedes and white gives way once again to green and gold. Professor Tong Wong is an economist and an SDSU extension specialist. She specializes in sustainable agriculture production and natural resource economics. She attended the 2017 Sioux Empire Farm Show to discuss cover crop economics and to speak with South Dakota farmers. Tong Wong joins us now with an overview of what farmers are saying as they look ahead at 2017. Professor Wong, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi. Yeah.
We're reaching you from Brookings. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thank
good.
You. Yeah.
Let's start with what cover crop is exactly. Can you explain that to me?
The cover crops are the crops the farmers plant to cover the soil when there's no cash crops in the field. So there are different types of cover crops, but generally their purpose is for the soil conservation purpose.
And is that something that is done often in South Dakota? Is it growing in popularity?
I just found out a SEER survey that they describe the percentage because they carried out a survey from the past 5 years. I found that the percentage have generally increased over the years. So 10 years ago, they are only 18%, but now nationally, they are more than 80%. So, Yeah, it grows a lot over the past 10 years.
So what's behind that increase? 80% nationally versus 10 years ago, 18% people were using this. What's causing that to expand so rapidly?
I think from my panel discussion in the last Thursday from the Sufo Farm Show, I heard the producers, they have been growing cover crops since the, I think, early 2000s. They have mentioned about the economic profit from growing cover crops. So I think the producers found the benefits from the economic side, from the soil organic matter side. So that's why they are spreading the words to their neighbors. I think that's mainly the reason they are growing. So, and farmers are increasingly realized the importance of conserving soil on their farm. So I think that's the reasons for the increasing adoption over the last 10 years. Yeah.
Professor Wang, is this something that was done a long time ago and has kind of been brought back, or is this brand new technology and brand new research and information available to farmers now?
You mean the cover crop adoption?
Right, sort of the concept of it. Is it an old idea made new again, or is it a new idea?
You know, I'm from the economic side, so I'm not quite sure, but from the farmers, you know, they talk about their experience. You know, they used a no-till back in 1990s, but it seems that the cover crop haven't been introduced to them back in 1990s, and they learned about the cover crop concept in the 2000s, and they actually said, you know, if they would have known this concept in 1990s, they definitely would, you know, incorporate on their farm back then, instead of waiting another 10 years for implementing the cover crop practice. So I believe that this concept is brand new for the South Dakota farmers. You know, most of them just learned about in early 2000s. In 1990s, I think, you know, very little is heard about cover crops among the farmers. Yeah.
So let's talk about the economics of it. How do you calculate the value of something like cover crop production?
I use a partial budget calculation. That means I actually calculate the cost and returns that has been incurred from implementing the cover crops. So I calculate the added income, you know, and the added cost, and reduce income and reduce cost. So basically, there are the positive side and the negative side from implementing cover crops. So from the cover crop, I actually did the cover crop plus grazing. So I assume that this cover crop is planted for the grazing purpose. So basically, the added cost from the cover crop, there are seeding cost, planting cost, cover crop termination cost. And for the grazing side, there are the fencing cost, the water tank cost, and the water hauling cost. So I assume those are the added cost. Because of cover crops. And then there's some benefits, that is the reduced forage cost, because the farmers wouldn't need that much forage because they are grazing on cover crops. So I calculated the first year benefits and the second year benefits from the cover crop plus grazing. So from my calculation, there is a $17 per acre benefit. You know, that means a profitability increase on the farm in the first year, and on the second year, there are $43 increase on the second year. So the reason is because the fencing costs, the water tank costs, all these last for at least 10 years. So they incur that on the first year, they wouldn't incur that on the second year. So that's for the grazing purpose. So there is a quite a lot economic profit increase on the field.
Does it stay standard at that? So what I'm hearing is $17 per acre benefit during that first year, as you have to invest in things like fencing, and then the second year, $43 a year per acre benefit. Does that keep going indefinitely, or does it fall off at a certain point?
I think the second year is pretty stable from the year onward. But there is what I calculate is the short term, so I didn't take account of the long term benefits, such as the increased soil water holding capacity So that actually reduces the risk of yield reduction due to the drought. And then the soil organic matter increase, so that would reduce nitrogen application rate in the long term. So I didn't quite calculate those in the long term. So what I calculate the short term. So in the long term, I think is could be slightly more than the second year. So it shouldn't decrease much. That is based on the grazing value. So some people actually didn't use the cover crop for grazing, so maybe that they would have expect some cash crop profit increase to offset the cover crop cost.
Okay, so if they're not using the cover crop for grazing, what's the alternative?
The alternative is just the cover crop growing and terminating, and then they expect something happens in the soil, and then the cash crop the yield might increase, but there's in the long term is surely beneficial for the cash crop because it's beneficial for the soil. Mm-hmm. So,
do you have to have an initial investment then set aside? Is it? I guess I'm not quite sure how the economics work when that $17 per acre benefit in the first year kicks in. Is that after the season, and you need to have some capital up front to invest?
Yeah. There is some investing cost every year, like the seeding cost, the planting cost, and termination cost. So those are the investment costs you have to do every year because you have to plant the seed, and there is those costs invested. And what I calculate is there are some costs involved in the grazing part. So like the fencing cost, the water tank cost. So that's the investment for the grazing portion. So that actually does not need to be incurred every year because those investment costs last for more than 10 years. But the seeding cost, the cover crop seed, the planting cost, and termination cost, that needs to be incurred every year. So there are different parts of the cost. Yeah.
So when you say termination cost, that means you have to get that crop off the field, off the soil. Is that what you mean by termination cost?
Exactly, yes. Yeah, before the cash crop is planted, the cover crop has to be getting off the soil, yeah.
All right, so tell me what the cover crop is. What are they planting?
I think I actually took the data from the South Dakota State University, the Southeast Farm Experiment Station. So I took the data they are using. So they have different seed. So there is a low-residue legume blend.
Mm-hmm.
So and then they have the high-residue grass blend, and then they have the equal blend. So there are different purposes of those different blends. So I learned that there is the legume blend. They are mainly for the nitrogen. So they are supplying nitrogen to the mm-hmm. soil. And then there's the grass. So grass are mainly to provide the erosion control because they grow really fast. And then there's brassicas. Brassicas are for, like, the radish. They have the deep root. So they actually help with the water infiltration. So there are different seeds for different purposes. So the I think the farmers, they actually choose the seed that best meet their purpose on their farm.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Professor Tong Wong. She's an economist with SDSU. And Professor Wong, I'm wondering what kind of, you went to the 2017 Sioux Empire Farm Show to talk about cover crop economics, and I'm wondering what kind of feedback you got from farmers.
The farmers, actually, after my presentation, the three producers, they went on to introduce themselves and about their practices on their farm. So the farmers, they give me the feedback is they kind of ask me about, you know, what is the timing to end the cover crops, what's the timing to start the cover crops, and then the grazing practices, like how much percentage of grass do they need to graze before, they move to the next field. So they ask some practical questions about the how to kind of incorporate cover crops on their farm. So they actually haven't tried cover crops before. So that's why they want to learn more about the practices so that they can better implement cover crops on their farm.
So they asked some practical questions. Do you have practical answers that you can sort of highlight now? Or is that a more in-depth conversation? When do you start and how do you make that transfer to using cover crop?
Yeah, I think one of the questions is they ask about, you know, the grazing on the cover crops. So they ask whether you should eat half and leave half like you graze on the pasture. So actually that part, I'm not sure how the experiment they did it, but so for some experienced producers, they actually have used the cover crops for the grazing purposes before. So they let them know that for if you graze cover crops, you just act like you're grazing the pastures. So it's pretty the same. You know, the pastures, if you graze half and leave half. So if you graze cover crops, you also want to graze half and leave half. So you don't want to overgraze the cover crops, you know, just like you don't want to overgraze the pastures. So that's some practical tips I heard from the producers.
Interesting. Professor Tong Wong, it's always a pleasure to get some insight on the economics of agriculture. So we really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's really my pleasure to talk here. Thanks.
Welcome back to In the Moment. Mike Thompson is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Suffolk. We're going to talk about the big news of the week that lurks beneath the other big news of the week. I'm talking about President Donald Trump's pick to replace Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. We've heard that announcement was coming Thursday. We've heard it's coming Tuesday, and we've heard it's coming today. So Mike Thompson is joining us on the phone. Welcome to In the Moment, Mike.
Thank you.
You've had a busy morning. We appreciate you making time for us. So let's start here with the pending announcement. Just for background, let's go ahead and say that Justice Antonin Scalia passed away and his seat has been vacant for a while. What has the consequences of that been?
Well, the consequences was just 8 justices on there. Some of the time the justices have been split at 4-4. Which results in the lower court's opinion remaining the law for that case.
President Trump has said that he's looking for someone in the mold of Antonin Scalia. That's in quotations, in the mold of Antonin Scalia. What would that be? Tell me about Justice Scalia and what mold he fit.
When I think of Justice Scalia in his mold, he is, and some of these adjectives, people use different adjectives in describing a justice like him, but he was an originalist. When he was interpreting the Constitution, he would look back to the time, what the law was and how people were handling situations at the time of the drafting of the Constitution. And then he would even go back farther into English legal history to determine the process of how that law developed. So that's how he interpreted the Constitution, and in that way, he gets labeled a conservative justice or a restraint justice, which means he didn't see the Constitution, as I understand it, he didn't see the Constitution as something that should reflect policy that governs the current age. That's my take on
I'm letting that soak in, not that it shouldn't reflect policy that governs the current age. That's it. What does that mean? How does that play out? Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I can give you an example. The Supreme Court, there in the Supreme Court's death penalty jurisprudence, the Supreme Court uses a phrase that is the evolving standards of decency. So our current Supreme Court, when it hears death penalty appeals, it does look at what are other nations doing with the death penalty and how does that fit into the evolving standards of decency of American society, which looks at the Constitution as something that is malleable and can be formed to reflect what current societal attitudes are. And I don't mean to say that the court sort of takes the pulse of the populace like a legislature might. But the court looks at what states are doing with regard to the death penalty and what other countries' legislatures are doing with regard to the death penalty. So kind of that kind of thing. I don't think Scalia would necessarily view that standard and apply it in his interpretation of the Constitution.
All right. But so you use the word. Go ahead. On the other hand,
people get, I think they get worried about this new pick as, well, if this new pick is like Scalia, then, as we've seen in the Right to Life marches and things, then we're going to see a disruption of Roe versus Wade. The thing about justices like Scalia, the originalists and restraint justices, there is a doctrine in the common law, which is judicial law, a doctrine called stare decisis, or stand by decided matters, where justices they understand that they have to keep the common law as uniform as they can. And it's in my opinion, it's more likely for a restraint justice like Justice Scalia to pay attention to that doctrine and be really reluctant to upset settled law.
Hmm. I went back and
go ahead.
You go ahead. Having said that, what? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Having said that, I'm just blabbering probably. But after the couple cases after Roe, though, to counter what I just said again, a couple cases after Roe, Scalia did express a desire to overturn Roe versus Wade. So.
And when you look, on the national news coverage, which obviously is not necessarily the best way to take the pulse of what's happening, and sometimes it helps you take the pulse of how people are responding to what's happening, you hear that a lot, that Roe v. Wade kind of comes up as something that people are concerned will change or be challenged. Other people are incredibly hopeful that it will be addressed in a new way. I went back and listened to your conversation after the election with Kara Hetland on Dakota Midday, and you mentioned that then, that you didn't really think that was going to be a big issue, that it would be overturned. Are people just sort of reacting to a topic that gets them, incites their passion and sort of missing the facts here?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a lack of education as to how the Supreme Court works and how its jurisprudence is formed. First of all, for them to upset a settled decision like Roe, a challenging case would have to be nearly exactly on the same footing as Roe was factually. And then the Supreme Court is very, very reluctant to decide cases based on the Constitution. They will find any way to avoid the constitutional issue. They'll look at procedural issues, they'll look at maybe there are statutory law issues that they could use to resolve the case. So it would have to be a very perfect challenge to Roe, and I'm not sure that perfect challenge could exist today. But I could be wrong.
We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Let's look at this short list that President Trump has right now. Do you have some names in front of you, or of who these sort of final two or three candidates might be? It's not Merrick Garland.
No, it's not. It's not. So I don't have the names in front of me. No.
So what I found is, go ahead.
The last I read, there were five, I think, and they were all federal court judges.
Mm.
What you have?
I'm seeing that as well. And then finally, and those are not sources from the administration, as far as I'm concerned. People are sort of guessing at this point. Are there, what do you think of those, those names that he's sort of floating out? Highly qualified and ready for the job to begin with? Are they qualified candidates?
I believe they are. Just knowing that they're, I haven't done detailed study of them individually, but knowing that they're federal judges, they understand the courts and how the courts work. They're coming to the Supreme Court bench from a federal bench just one tier lower than theirs. And they've already gone through confirmation proceedings. I think that if you're looking at the types of people that President Trump could select, I think a federal judge, a sitting federal judge, is one of the safest.
Mm. Let's talk about the court as it is right now. Other people who could retire during President Trump's term or through their age could somehow impact the makeup of the court. Ruth Bader right. Ginsburg is probably not going anywhere, right? she would want to stick
healthy.
Around.
Yeah, she would.
She has expressed, you know, some disagreement with President Trump when he was running for office. So that's why we're kind of making that comment there that she's going to start lifting weights and eating healthy to make sure that she doesn't go anywhere. Who else? Anthony Kennedy was reported appointed by Ronald Reagan. How about him? Does he look at retirement?
I don't think so. From what I've been able to see from him, I don't think he's looking to retire. I don't think most of those Supreme Court justices they don't really retire until health prevents them from getting to the bench or they die.
So there isn't a strategy to planning your retirement around who's in the White House.
Ooh, maybe. I would hope not, but maybe they have that strategy. I don't know.
How do the justices really view their job then, to insulate themselves from what's happening in the other two branches?
That's the way I'd like to think it happens. That especially once, I judge that from local experience with judges and our state Supreme Court. There is something about putting on that judicial robe that insulates you from, or that you use to insulate yourself from the politics that happen around you. And I think that's the same on the U.S. Supreme Court. Lawrence Tribe wrote a great book, God Save This Honorable Court. And in that book, he did a pretty good study of how justices follow their political leanings, if at all. So the fact that they're appointed by a Republican president, does that mean that they're more likely to express Republican values? And his conclusion was no, that the evidence showed that that's not the case. And if you look back to the Warren court in the 1960s, Earl Warren, Republican governor of California, comes on the bench, and the 60s were the biggest amount of criminal justice law that came out of the court in a long period of time. And some people would view that as the Warren Court took a very liberal approach to criminal justice at that time.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. My guest is Mike Thompson. He's Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. And I'm wondering about executive orders and sort of this three branches of government, the Obama legacy of signing executive orders, and how President Trump is sort of beginning his first 2 weeks with what seems like a flurry of executive orders. Is that how you see it, or is that overreacting to what he's doing right now?
No,
is it pretty standard?
No, I don't. I don't think you're overreacting. It does look like a flurry to me. The executive order, especially when it deals with the Supreme Court, has said over and over that when it comes to foreign policy, the president is our chief executive officer when it comes to foreign policy. He's our foreign negotiator and things like that. But when the president, back in the 1950s, when the president tried to seize the steel mills to provide for steel for military equipment, he did that by executive order. And one of the justices wrote a now celebrated opinion showing when a president has the greatest amount of power when issuing an executive order. And the greatest power the president has with an executive order is if his executive order reflects a grant of power from Congress. So if you look at President Trump's, his travel executive order, in the Immigration and Naturalization Act, the Congress does give him some discretion to issue an executive order and determine if it's in the if entry would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. The president can, by executive order, do certain things. So that's when the with an executive order, that's when the president's power is at its greatest, is when he's acting with the explicit permission of Congress. In the Immigration and Naturalization Act, however, there's another provision of that statute that says that his executive order power can't be used discriminatorily based on race, ethnicity, national origin, and those things. So there is some argument already about the effectiveness of that order. But I think most executive orders are ceremonial. They're just some sort of expression of what the executive believes the policy should be.
So Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, and again I'm quoting, the courts are going to determine whether it's too broad, and he's referring there to President Trump's executive order regarding immigration. So is that what we're looking at, that will end up in the courts at various levels?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. All right.
And I think over the weekend, a bunch of judges, federal judges, maybe three, have already entered orders staying the implementation of that executive order.
So we're all about to be pretty busy as we watch this unfold, right?
Well, now, there is one good thing out of this, maybe, that everybody's going to know their Constitution by the time
everyone's
done with this.
Everyone's going to know their Constitution. We're going to help them figure it out. Mike Thompson, come back and help us figure out those details in the weeks ahead. I appreciate your
time. I'd love to.